It's time for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Welcome to the program. On today's show, we'll feature a piece from CBS News about ABLE accounts. We'll hear parts of an interview of one of the authors of the ADA from Mother Jones, and a piece from Healthline about assistive technology for the visually impaired. We'll hear several other articles as well, beginning with this piece from the March issue of the Braille Monitor entitled "A Tribute to Tom Stevens, A Leader and a Friend" by Gary Wunder. From the editor, "I hardly need to introduce Gary Wunder to Monitor readers, except perhaps to provide the context that, among many other things, he's a longtime leader in the NFB of Missouri. Here he pays loving tribute to another longtime leader of that affiliate. Tom Stevens died on Saturday, January 18, 2025, at the age of 92. He was a Federationist since the mid-1970s. When I moved from Columbia to Warrensburg to finish my degree, I got Tom to come to his first meeting. At that meeting, or the one just after, he was elected as our Columbia chapter president. Tom was not unaccustomed to being a part of leadership, having been a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. He was, however, surprised to be elected, but he learned a lot about the organization quickly and was not at all passive. He led by example and set a pace that would challenge any of us. He soon came to be a part of the State Board of Directors. At his first board meeting, he heard the body talk about closing down its longtime newsletter, The Blind Missourian, and he immediately volunteered to edit it. When he was told the problem wasn't just the editing, but that there was no funding, he said, "Well, if I'm going to have something to edit, I guess I'll have to fund it too." This was one of the many out-of-pocket sacrifices he made, because the affiliate simply had little in the way of money to address our tremendous desire to be active and to have programs. Tom became the state president in 1977 and served one term, which lasted until 1979. During his tenure, Missouri saw the passage of the Model White Cane Law, the Fraudulent Portrayal of Blindness Act, and a regulation from Missouri's insurance commissioner making it illegal to charge people more for insurance based on blindness alone. When we sometimes decry the length of time to get a bill passed, we should keep in mind that our White Cane Bill passed on its eighth introduction. For all of our work, Tom concluded that we were virtually invisible to the executive leadership of the state. He reasoned that if our governor was going to give a state of the state report, we should do a state of the state on the affairs of the blind, and we did. Whether the governor read that report or not, I do not know. But I know that both times that we produced it, he acknowledged its receipt with appreciation and made sure we got invited to some of his press conferences. For several years, Tom was the director of the Missouri Bureau for the Blind, which is now called Rehabilitation Services for the Blind. To my knowledge, he was the first blind person ever to head the agency, and only one agency head since has been blind. During his tenure, the employment of blind people in the agency went up, and those who acted as though they were royalty and blind people's subservient subjects were removed. This was no small accomplishment in state government. After his service at the Bureau, Tom was very involved in what we used to call the Associates Program to raise funds for our national treasury. This meant asking for donations and making people associate members of our organization. It also meant creating a newsletter called the Associate Raiser to encourage recruitment. The newsletter was available in print and on tape. Again, it was financed by Tom and was typed and put on tape by his incredible wife and Federationist, Helen. One of the things that made Tom very sad was that he concluded blind people were reluctant to ask others who were not blind to make donations. He could never figure out whether this was a reaction to being thought of as blind beggars, or whether we simply did not spend enough time on the mechanics of fundraising, though all of us knew we needed the money for our programs. These issues remain with us today. Tom has been active in almost everything we have done. He has actively supported the work we have pursued in our state capital and in Washington, D.C. He did this long before we could afford to send anyone to what we then called the March on Jefferson City and the March on Washington. The harsh truth was that there was not enough funding in our treasury to carry on programs unless people who were elected to positions were willing to make significant financial contributions. Today, calling across the state or county is part of a flat monthly bill. But when Tom was in elective office, calling long distance was expensive. There was no email, so sharing an important document meant typing it, taking it to a store that made copies, collating, folding, and putting the document into an envelope, which then needed to be addressed, stamped, and often delivered to a postal box. Since Tom believed that lack of communication too often translated into the perception that we were doing nothing, communicate he did, again, at significant cost in time and his own money. When the National Federation of the Blind helped in the development of the Kurzweil reading machine, and we decided that Columbia, Missouri was the right place to have one, Tom hired a man who had a track record as a fundraiser. Since there was little to no funding in the Treasury, Tom not only accepted the responsibility for hiring him, but also for paying him. Initially, our thought was that we would get back the money we paid when donations started to flow in. It was our good fortune that the buzz we created about the machine was so successful that the Ellis Library Alumni Fund purchased one, and the library agreed to house it. Grateful doesn't begin to cover the emotion we felt. But what about the month the fundraiser spent and the costs for his hotel, meals, travel, and other expenses? We had no money to reimburse our generous Federationist, but Tom's laughing response was, "Oh well, that's the way it goes. We have our reading machine." No tribute to Tom would be complete without acknowledging the significant work of his wife, Helen. For a long time, Helen has been very active, though at first, her visible activity was fairly limited by the raising of their children and making sure that Tom had the time and energy to be actively involved. She drove countless hours. She acted not only as Tom's reader, but she read many other things on tape that Tom sent to us. His financial sacrifices were also her sacrifices, and to both, we offer our undying gratitude. And now from CBS News, Money Watch, ABLE accounts allow Americans with disabilities to save and invest. Here's how. Updated on March 21st, 2025. Paul Seferik, 32, of Lincoln, Nebraska, has worked in the food industry since he was 21, delivering for quick-service restaurants like Raising Cane's and stocking groceries at stores like Trader Joe's. With his earning, Seferik, who has Down syndrome, recently bought a treadmill to stay active when the weather's bad and helped cover the cost of braces for his teeth. That's unusual, financially speaking, and it's thanks in part to a little-known savings account called an ABLE account, which lets people with disabilities save money beyond the $2,000 asset limit that's linked to benefits like Supplemental Security Income and Medicaid. Without the account, Seferik could have risked losing government assistance if he had more than $2,000 in assets saved at one time in a given month. With this ABLE account, we don't have to worry as much, said Deb Seferik, 71, Paul's mother, with whom he lives. It's nice that he can work and save and not have that be held against him. Named for the 2014 law that created them, the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act, ABLE accounts have been available since 2016 to individuals identified by a doctor as having a disability before the age of 26. Next year, they'll become available to those identified before the age of 46, which will increase access to an additional 6 million people, including 1 million veterans, according to Indiana State Treasurer Daniel Elliott, who administers the accounts in his state. An estimated 8 million people nationwide already qualify. The fact that it used to be that individuals could only save up to $2,000 or they could lose benefits, that was really restricting a lot of families, Elliott said. People were forced into a position where they couldn't save for their futures. Now we're seeing average account balances of ABLE accounts between $11,000 and $12,000. Generally, ABLE accounts may reach totals of $100,000 without affecting Supplemental Security income. Lifetime balance limits for the various state ABLE accounts can range from around $300,000 to $500,000. They're administered by state treasurers, and the vast majority can be set up online via their websites. Some ABLE plans accept paper applications as well. Anyone can contribute to an ABLE account. Anyone can contribute to an ABLE account, including the account owner, friends, family, organizations, nonprofits, and employers, up to $19,000 per year in 2025. If the account owner is able to work and not already contributing to a workplace retirement plan, they can contribute an additional amount equal to their yearly gross income. For 2025, that amount is up to an additional $15,560 to $18,810, depending on the state administering the account. There are also tax advantages. Investment earnings from ABLE accounts remain untaxed as long as money taken from the account is used for qualified disability expenses, such as medical treatment, education, tutoring, and job training. Account holders may choose from a number of investment options for the funds in their accounts or hold and save the money without investing it further. Awareness is the big challenge. Elliott said raising awareness of the accounts is the biggest challenge for the National Association of State Treasurers, NAST, for which he's also the Secretary Treasurer. Many people are used to the idea that if I have a disability or my child has one, it could endanger their benefits to save money, he said. We as a state and as a country need to start reaching out to people and saying, look, you actually can save money now. You can save towards the purchase of a home. The hardest thing right now is getting that message out. We need more people to be aware things have changed. According to NAST's data, just 186,641 ABLE accounts existed at the end of 2024. Despite an estimated 8 million people qualifying. When the age limit is raised, the accounts will also become available to people whose disabilities may have been the result of an accident in adulthood or developed later in life, such as after a COVID infection. Andrew Warren, Senior Associate for Policy and Research at the Financial Health Network, who studies the financial circumstances of Americans with disabilities, said that the vast majority of people surveyed for a 2023 report by the organization did not know these accounts existed. Less than 1% of eligible individuals have these accounts, Warren said. Our research shows that one of the major barriers to becoming financially healthy for this vulnerable group is asset limits. But there's an information disconnect between caseworkers and direct service providers on the ground and administrators of ABLE accounts. Here's what to know. How do I know if I qualify for an ABLE account? Two online resources, ABLE Today and the ABLE National Resource Center, can guide you through questions to determine if you or a friend or family member qualifies. Right now, ABLE accounts are for people whose disability began before age 26 and people for whom the disability is terminal or long-term, more than 12 months, and for whom the disability causes marked and severe functional limitations. A qualifying person must also meet one of the following criteria: being eligible for Supplemental Security Income, SSI, or Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, because of the disability, or a doctor has diagnosed the disability, physical or mental. In 2026, the age limit for ABLE accounts will rise to 46. What can I do to prepare if I or a family member will qualify next year? You can begin educating yourself now about the process of setting up the account, so you can add money and fund the account right away beginning in January of 2026. Family, friends, and organizations may also begin setting money aside with the intention of contributing it to the accounts in the individual's name as of January 1st. Next up is that piece from Healthline entitled, Assistive Technology That Can Help with Vision Loss, by Mike Hoskins, medically reviewed by Jenna Stoddard, OD, FAAO, published on March 24, 2025. Audio tools, mobile apps, and vision magnifiers can help people with vision loss navigate their lives. Tools and tech options may help read prescription labels, get the news online, or find out what's happening on favorite TV shows. Losing your sight will affect everything you do each day, whether you experience low vision or blindness. However, new technologies and tools can help you navigate these vision challenges. Here are some assistive technologies that may be worth discussing with your healthcare team and support system to help you live with vision loss. Navigating your health. Many assistive technologies can help you along your healthcare journey. A 2023 study shows that readers and other assistive visual aids benefit people with low vision. The American Academy of Ophthalmology, AAO, recommends a variety of tech and tools for people with vision loss or blindness. These can include tools that help you order and read prescriptions, take your medications daily, portion your food, manage your overall wellness and any health conditions you may have. Many of these types of tech are useful not only for healthcare, but also for other areas of your life. Prescription readers. You can find different mobile apps and technologies that read prescription labels and speak aloud. Pharmacies and companies specializing in this technology may offer many options, including ScriptTalk, SpokenRx at CVS, Walgreens Taking Pill Reminder, Be My Eyes app, which connects people with vision loss to sighted company representatives in a multitude of industries and services. Screen readers. Screen readers can include apps on your smartphone that can read text. A 2018 review points to the benefits of screen reading tech, but researchers note there isn't strong evidence proving any benefit from specific products or types of screen reader technology. Magnifiers. Magnifiers can include software on your smartphone or a handheld magnifying device that enlarges items for better viewing. Smart glasses. Smart glasses are a newer type of technology in which you put on a pair of frame lenses and the tech speaks aloud, whether you're reading or looking around you. One of these options is Meta smart glasses. Research shows these glasses can benefit people with vision impairment. Moving around your home. Assistive technologies can also help people with vision loss move around their homes safely and efficiently. Research shows that while these may be beneficial tools and tech, many people with low vision don't use them as often as might be needed. Smart home tech. Smart technology is now available in many homes, such as smart appliances. Smart appliances and devices can be connected to vision loss-friendly apps that can help people with vision loss cook meals with the stove, oven, toaster, microwave, air fryer, and Instapot, know how much of an item is in the refrigerator, operate laundry machines from other rooms or floors, adjust thermostats, turning inside and outdoor lights on and off. Talking devices. Talking devices like Amazon Alexa and Google Home allow people to ask questions and get audio answers. They help people with vision loss easily and quickly access information, from the weather forecast and TV lineups to contact information for new doctors. Smart apps. Many mobile and smartphone apps can help people navigate their surroundings and places. For example, apps like TapTapSee use your device's camera to take pictures or videos of objects and identify them for you. This next article comes from USA Today. It is entitled, Citing Trump Order, Justice Department Cuts Disability Guidance for Businesses, by Ken Altucker. Published March 20, updated March 25th, 2025. The Justice Department this week announced the removal of 11 guidelines for businesses seeking to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. The agency said removing the unnecessary and outdated guidance will help businesses comply with the federal disability law and eliminate unnecessary review. The agency cited a January 20 executive order signed by President Donald Trump that called on federal agencies to take action to lower the cost of living. The 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act extends civil rights protections to the estimated 1 in 4 adults with disabilities. Rules and guidance have been added over the years, including during the COVID-19 pandemic, to specify protections for people with disabilities. Protections are necessary and timely, advocates say. Advocacy groups said the rollback of some guidelines could erode protections for people under federal law. The American Association of People with Disabilities said the department's move eliminates protections that are necessary and timely, and the organization is very concerned about these changes. 5 of the 11 guidelines deleted from the website ADA.gov were enacted in 2021 during the height of the pandemic. For example, the agency removed guidelines around masking, once recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention during the public health emergency. But the disabilities group said some of the targeted COVID-19 related guidance is still relevant today. The federal agency removed language clarifying protections for people at restaurants' outdoor eating areas, known as streeteries, and for employees with disabilities during the pandemic. COVID continues to be a threat to our nation's health, and COVID and related conditions like long COVID cause disabilities on a daily basis, the American Association of People with Disabilities said in a statement. Further, the streeteries that began during the COVID public health emergency continue to persist and create obstacles for people with disabilities using public rights of way. The two other provisions rescinded by the Justice Department contained language related to a person's right to use a service animal and whether people with disabilities could have visitors at hospitals or medical facilities. Both provisions were adopted in 2021 when COVID-19 was widely circulating in communities and hospitals and health facilities, enacted restrictions to reduce transmission of the virus. The agency eliminated three guidelines describing ADA requirements for expanding businesses. Those included language to maintain accessible features, gather input from customers with disabilities, and customer service practices for hotel and lodging guests with disabilities. The final three excised regulations dealt with reaching out to customers with disabilities, assistance at self-service gas stations, and steps lodging facilities must take to comply with the disabilities law. The six non-COVID-19 guidelines, now removed from ADA.gov, had been added from 1999 to 2009, spanning Democratic and Republican administrations. Justice Department highlights tax breaks for businesses. In addition to eliminating the guidelines, the Justice Department highlighted tax incentives for businesses to help pay expenses of making improvements for customers or employees with disabilities. Mac Warner, a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the agency's Civil Rights Division, said the Justice Department wants businesses and the public to understand their rights and obligations. Putting money back in the pockets of business owners helps everyone by allowing those businesses to pass on cost savings to consumers and bolster the economy, Warner said in a statement. Trump's executive order, which did not specify the Americans with Disabilities Act, singled out energy regulations the president said led to higher costs for Americans. He also said regulatory requirements led to higher housing costs. A 2022 survey released by the CDC estimated that more than 70 million U.S. adults had a disability. Nearly 44% of adults 65 and older had a disability, and people with a disability were more likely to experience the effects of long COVID, the survey said. The American Association of People with Disabilities said people often experience barriers in retail, lodging, and healthcare settings. Individuals, employers, and other entities still need this guidance and still benefit from it, the disabilities group said. Well, our next article is that Mother Jones piece regarding the ADA. Before we begin that article, I want to remind you that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now, that article from Mother Jones. The ADA is turning 35, and it's in Trump's crosshairs. Tony Coelho, the Americans with Disabilities Act's main author, sees a new wave of threats looming for disability rights. By Julia Metro, published March 24, 2025. On July 26, 1990, then-President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law. The bill's primary author was former Democratic House Representative Tony Coelho of California, who was diagnosed with epilepsy at the age of 22. The ADA's passage, which disability rights demonstrations like the Capitol Crawl contributed to, exemplified an area of more bipartisan efforts to push civil rights forward. Testifying before the House in support of the ADA in 1988, Coelho said it was time that our government recognized our abilities and gave us the dignity to do what we can do. Living with epilepsy was not easy for Coelho, who became suicidal and drunk by noon, in part due to challenges in finding a job after he revealed his diagnosis. Coelho had already been barred from studying to become a Catholic priest due to his disability, which was diagnosed during a medical exam required of applicants to the priesthood. There was no way we could get a major bill like this passed if it wasn't bipartisan. Since the bill was signed into law, disabled Americans have benefited from a much wider array of protections in the workforce, in education, and in the ability to access public places and private spaces open to the public, such as stores and restaurants. But in a world where disability rights victories and disabled people themselves are being attacked by anti-DEI activists who have President Donald Trump's ear, disability civil rights feel a little more fragile. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, another essential and wide-ranging item of civil rights legislation, is also in peril. Most notably through a lawsuit filed by 17 Republican state attorneys general and led by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, as my colleague Sarah Zlagy reported in October. Ahead of the ADA's 35th anniversary, I spoke with Coelho about the bill's legacy, the importance of bipartisanship in its passage, and other provisions he wishes he'd included in it at the time. The Americans with Disabilities Act is turning 35 this year. As the primary author of the ADA, what does that mean to you? We've made a lot of progress. It obviously hasn't solved every problem. Most civil rights bills don't immediately. Civil rights bills, including the ADA, are mere pieces of paper that have to be enforced. The Biden administration enforced it aggressively, probably the best of any administration. I don't know what the Trump administration will do. I'm very concerned. The inclination, I should say, is that they're not going to enforce civil rights laws, and they've cut a lot of people out of the Justice Department. ADA has been the law of the land on a bipartisan basis for 35 years, and now Trump is cutting DOJ enforcement. Social Security and education programs established to make sure those of us with disabilities are given the same opportunity to succeed as everyone else. This last year, a major accomplishment was that we convinced the Biden administration to sign a rule in regard to access to the internet. We have not amended the ADA legislatively on purpose because there was an attempt to really gut the ADA a few years ago by the House of Representatives when it was under Republican control. The ADA now is the law of the land, and in different varieties, the law of the land in over 50 different countries. So it's had a huge impact internationally, and that's an acknowledgement by those countries that those individuals in their country with disabilities should have some rights. Is it complete? No, but that's true with all civil rights laws. What did it take to secure bipartisan support for the ADA? As a staffer for Democratic Representative Bernie Sisk, I tried to get my boss to introduce amendments to cover us in regard to housing or transportation. I found out the disability community was not protected, and we needed legislation to protect it. When I got elected, I didn't realize there was a grassroots movement over the years trying to build up support for an ADA-like law. But I got a call from President Reagan's Disability Council asking me if I would consider working with them in regards to legislation. We did a bipartisan, bicameral thing that was very deliberately done because I realized that there was no way we could get a major bill like this passed if it wasn't bipartisan. On the Senate side, it was extremely bipartisan. You started with Kansas Senator Bob Dole, who was majority leader at the time, and then you had Orrin Hatch, a Republican from Utah, a Mormon. He said to me at one point, "The Mormon Church feels that you're a child of God, and we support the disability community." He was a conservative Republican. And then we had Dole, a moderate, but the leader of the Senate, and then Ted Kennedy, who had several family members with different disabilities, and was sort of the spiritual leader of the Senate. That made it really strong for Democrats. We had Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, whose brother had a disability. So the four of them were a great bipartisan group, and the three of them had personal relationships with disabilities. On my side, I was the House Majority Whip, so I was third ranking in the House, but I was the only one who acknowledged living with a disability. Democratic House Speaker Tom Foley called me in and said that he thought the bill was too broad and the public would react negatively and wanted me to break it up into multiple pieces of legislation. I told him no. I'd been elected just like he'd been elected, so I thought I had the same rights. Then, on the 15th of June, 1989, I left the Congress and asked Steny Hoyer to take the lead in the House. His wife had a disability, so it made it perfect. What aspects of the ADA do you think have most changed disabled people's day-to-day lives? Well, the most important thing is that it gave us our civil rights. In other words, prior to the ADA, people could openly tell us, because of your epilepsy, we're not going to hire you, or we're not going to hire you because you're blind, or you're hearing impaired, or we're not going to hire you because you use a wheelchair. They could do that openly and aggressively without suffering any consequences. The whole thing of basic civil rights and then enforcement by the Justice Department is what makes it so significant. If you want to get into specifics, for accommodations, I think that the basic right of having a civil rights law backing you up was the most significant thing the bill did. What type of conversations have disabled people had with you about the ADA? Those individuals who were born before 1990 understand how significant the ADA is. People born after that time just assume that that's been the law for 100 years. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's kind of interesting the difference of people who come up to me and so forth. I get a lot of calls from people all the time about something they've been denied, and so then I try to place them in touch with the right people to go ahead and get it enforced. At times, I will personally get involved, depending on what it is. I just did a walk to end epilepsy, and several people came up and discussed different problems and so forth. I always say that I wanted to be a priest, didn't get to be there, but I basically am a priest today, giving advice to people and helping people and so forth. So I think those things work in strange ways. What needs to happen next, especially at the federal level? In what ways do you hope that politicians continue to push for better disability policy? I do not want to open up the ADA so there would be no amendments because I want to protect it. If you open it up, you could lose it, and I don't want that. In regards to what else we need better enforcement. In regards to being hired for jobs, that's what gives us our independence. Like everybody else you know, if you have a job, you can pay taxes. Five presidents I met with, I said, "I only know of one community in the world that wants to pay taxes, and that's those of us with a disability, because that means we have a job. That means we have the right to buy a home, rent a home, a car, get married, take care of our family." Another thing people don't realize is that we can't, in a civil rights law, do much more than provide those basic rights. And so a lot of people say, "Well, why didn't you do X?" One of the things I wish we had done in the ADA was to include religion, include churches, and we decided not to because we would never have gotten the ADA passed, and so we literally left that open. This next article comes from the Associated Press. It's entitled, "Partial Blindness Hasn't Stopped Oklahoma State's Staley Hurd from Leading the Cowgirls into NCAAs," published March 21st, 2025, Storrs, Connecticut. Staley Hurd never set out to become a role model or the face for those who deal with visual impairment. The leading scorer for the Oklahoma State women's basketball team that will face South Dakota State in the first round of the NCAA women's basketball tournament has never let the fact that she is blind in her right eye stop her from realizing her dreams. She isn't about to start now. I get that a lot, actually, because I don't tend to like telling people that, because I don't want them to think of it as an excuse, said Hurd, who was born without vision in her right eye. This is how I've been my whole life. I know nothing different. So it's pretty cool how people can look at that and say, you're a good basketball player. But now that they know you are blind in one eye, it's even better. There might have been those who doubted whether her lack of vision in her right eye would keep Hurd from realizing her dream of playing major college basketball. Those messages never came from friends and family members. My parents, they really pushed that, and that was their message all the time, Hurd said. I never backed down. They never had to push that on me. I never backed down or shied away from it. The fact that the Oklahoma State coaching staff didn't realize Hurd was blind in one eye when they first started to watch the 5'11" sophomore from Sepulpa, Oklahoma play speaks volumes about her game. She is so humble, Oklahoma State women's basketball coach J.C. Hoyt said. It is not something that she talks about very much. I wish she did because it is so incredible and inspiring. I think she is such a great poster child for our program because we are very much about embracing adversity, not making excuses, not playing the victim. She is all about that. She doesn't do any of that. There aren't very many players in the country who would be able to handle that the way that she does. Hurd has enjoyed a breakout sophomore season, highlighted by a 34-point game against Texas Tech in the Big 12 quarterfinals and 25 points in the loss to Baylor in the semifinals. Hurd, who leads Oklahoma State in scoring at 16.7 points per game and with an average of 8.1 rebounds, joins Micah Gray as the Oklahoma natives projected to start in Saturday's NCAA tournament opener. She's more than happy to talk to the high school players who come to see the Cowgirls play and let them know that they don't need to leave Oklahoma to make an impact on the basketball court. Being close to home means a lot, Hurd said. A lot of people come and we can show these youngsters, especially the high school players who come and watch. I always come and talk to them. I think it means a lot. Next up, from the Disability Scoop, Trump says Ed Department will no longer handle special needs, by Michelle Diament, published March 25th, 2025. President Donald Trump said he will move special education oversight to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, but the plan is short on specifics, and it's unclear whether he has the authority to do so. Trump told reporters late last week that Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will be handling special needs and all of the nutrition programs. Those two elements will be taken out of the Department of Education, Trump said. The announcement came less than 24 hours after Trump signed an executive order aimed at fulfilling his campaign promise to shut down the Department of Education, and just over a week after the agency said it would slash its workforce by nearly half. the administration's changes at the Education Department are already facing multiple court challenges. The Education Department did not respond to questions about exactly what special education programs would be moving to the Department of Health and Human Services, what the process would look like, or when it would take place. Over the weekend, Secretary of Education Linda McMahon was less firm about the plan, telling CNN, "The programs for students with disabilities will more than likely rest in HHS." Kennedy said in a post on X that his department is fully prepared to take on the responsibility of supporting individuals with special needs, but representatives from the health agency similarly declined to comment on details. The push to move oversight of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act out of the Education Department is now prompting legal questions and other concerns from special education and disability advocates. This is not a change that can be made by executive order. It would require Congress to amend the law to abolish the U.S. Department of Education and amend the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act to move the Office of Special Education Programs from Ed to HHS, said Stephanie Smith Lee, co-director of policy and advocacy at the National Down Syndrome Congress, who served as director of the Education Department's Office of Special Education Programs under President George W. Bush. The IDEA specifies that there shall be within the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services in the Department of Education an Office of Special Education Programs, which shall be the principal agency in the department for administering and carrying out this title and other programs and activities concerning the education of children with disabilities. Even if the president could move IDEA oversight to the Department of Health and Human Services, doing so would be a step back 50 years, said Michael Uden, who served as Assistant Secretary of the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services under the Obama administration. Most children with disabilities are educated in general education classrooms alongside their typically developing peers. So breaking off special education is illogical, he said. This is not a health issue. This is not a medical issue. This is about educating kids with disabilities, Uden said. We're talking about making sure kids get a free, appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. What about health does that? Disability advocates are also raising concerns about how prepared the Department of Health and Human Services would be to oversee special education and what message it would send to house special education inside a health agency. Moving IDEA to the Department of Health and Human Services would promote a medical model of disability that could only lead to stigmatizing, segregating, and othering children with disabilities, said Robin Linscott, Director of Education and Family Policy at the ARC. HHS is not equipped to work directly with state education agencies who are delegated the responsibility to oversee local implementation of IDEA in school districts. Nor is HHS able to provide essential technical assistance to parents as is currently conducted. And here's another piece from the Disability Scoop, this one entitled "Medicaid Recipients Struggle to Find Mental Health Care. Looming Cuts Could Make It Harder." By Shalina Chatlani, published March 25, 2025. Sharmika Newton, a psychologist who has her own practice in Lansing, Michigan, is passionate about serving Black and Hispanic patients. They're often looking for therapists who will understand how their race, ethnicity, and culture may affect them, she said, and she helps provide that care. Medicaid is a major source of health care for people of color, but Newton can only afford to see a small number of Medicaid patients because the program pays her so much less than commercial insurance. Republicans in Congress are aiming to make extensive cuts to Medicaid, the joint federal-state health insurance program that covers a total of 72 million low-income people and people with disabilities, or one in five U.S. residents. If that happens, Newton and many other mental health providers worry that already low Medicaid reimbursement rates will stagnate or even decline. That would make it difficult for her to keep seeing Medicaid patients. Medicaid is probably one of the most challenging insurances to work with, Newton told Stateline. My biggest fear, if cuts happen, is that individuals won't have access to providers that are able to help them. Already, there is a shortage of mental health care providers. About 122 million people, or about 35% of the U.S. population, are living in an area with a mental health care professional shortage, according to data from the Federal Health Resources and Services Administration. If Medicaid reimbursement rates go down and more providers refuse to see those patients, the shortage would get worse. Nationwide, Medicaid covers nearly one in three working-age adults who live with mental illness, or about 15 million adults, according to health policy research organization KFF. The U.S. House Energy and Commerce Committee, which oversees Medicaid, is looking for at least $880 billion in budget savings over the next decade, largely to pay for extensive tax cuts. A March 5 letter from the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan research arm of Congress, confirmed that a cut of that size would have to come from either Medicaid or Medicare, the insurance program for older adults. President Donald Trump has said that Medicare is off the table, so that leaves Medicaid. Lawmakers are considering numerous options, including shrinking the federal government's share of the cost of covering people who become newly eligible for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. If that happens, states that opted to expand to cover those residents, adults with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level, would have to either increase their own spending or find savings elsewhere. That could mean removing some people from Medicaid rolls, eliminating coverage for certain services, or reducing reimbursement rates, any one of which could reduce Medicaid recipients' access to mental health care, said Stephen Gillespie, Director of Health Policy and Healthcare Financing at the American Psychological Association. Those actions would have a huge negative impact for behavioral health care, Gillespie told Stateline. Everyone's on pins and needles about the potential cuts right now. Variations across states, different challenges. In at least 15 states, more than 40% of people on Medicaid reported experiencing a mental health illness, according to a KFF analysis of 2021-2022 survey data from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Republicans in Congress are still hammering out whether or how they might cut Medicaid. Chris Pope, a senior fellow with the conservative-leaning policy group, the Manhattan Institute, told Stateline he doubts mental health services or reimbursement rates would be affected because the largest sources of spending are acute and long-term care. From a fiscal point of view, mental health is basically a drop in the bucket. It's not where the big savings are going to need to come from, Pope said. Medicaid reimbursement rates for mental health services vary dramatically from state to state. Reimbursement for an hour-long individual psychotherapy session ranged from $95 to $135 in 2022, according to a 2023 study published in the journal Health Affairs. States generally have flexibility in setting their physician reimbursement rates. So, if states have money to increase reimbursement rates, they can do that, Pope noted. And many states have done that. According to a January 2023 KFF report, Nearly two-thirds of the 44 states that responded to a survey said they increased behavioral health reimbursement rates for some Medicaid enrollees in 2022 or planned to in 2023. Oregon passed a bill during its 2022 session to raise the state's Medicaid behavioral health reimbursement rates by an average of 30% for providers who mostly see Medicaid patients in an effort to address mental health care workforce challenges. In 2022, the state had the fourth highest rate for unmet need in mental health treatment across the nation. Now, the state has one of the highest reimbursement rates. In Oregon, they actually have always really committed to paying providers well and giving cost of living updates so that it makes it much more attractive to providers providing Medicaid services, Jen Yerdy, a licensed counselor in Portland, Oregon, told Stateline. But Yerdy said the higher reimbursement rate is the bare minimum to keep providers interested. She said she helps her clients with case management, including assisting them with accessing social services and rental aid. It would be great if they would actually reimburse us more for all the case management things that we do. It would be great if they offer a lot more resources, Yerdy said. But behavioral health services, such as a psychological test to assess mental health function, are not one of the federally required Medicaid services, like a primary care doctor visit. Gillespie of the American Psychological Association noted the level of services offered across states also vary, and case management and psychological testing are exactly the types of services that may be on the chopping block as states consider cuts, he said. What states can and have done. Researchers at KFF point out four main ways states have been trying to address mental health workforce shortages for state Medicaid programs. They include increasing reimbursement rates, reducing administrative burden on providers, creating licensure compacts to allow providers to work across state lines, or reducing licensure requirements, and incentivizing participation by, for example, reimbursing providers quickly. Megan Cole, an associate professor of health policy at Boston University, told Stateline there are other options states could pursue, such as raising taxes to offset federal cuts and keeping reimbursement rates high. She also said Medicaid can ask primary care providers to start integrating preventative mental health screenings and services before care becomes acute and requires an emergency room visit. There are models of care that work well in this space, and not every state is currently implementing them. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for expansion of some of these integrated care models, Cole said. Another option she recommends is for states to invest in community health centers, where a lot of patients on Medicaid see mental health providers. And with that, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you for tuning in to the Disability News Program on SunSounds. I'm John Currie, your volunteer reader, urging you to keep listening to SunSounds of Arizona.